Thank you very much. It's nice to see a lot of you again. I remember right near my last day in Washington, my old friend Stuart Baker and I were at a meeting in Munich, and I was talking about how I was going to leave the White House, and he made the comment that for the first time in 6 years, you'll be able to say what you really think, which is the good news, but also the bad news is that for the first time in 6 years, nobody will care what you really think. I'm not sure how much anybody will care about what I have to say today, especially 10 years after, but let me make a few observations that maybe can kick off a discussion. This whole framework came about when the president, after the demise of healthcare reform, asked me to try to take a look at what he could do to continue the good economy, which then was in place. And he had this phrase talking about a bridge to the 21st century and what should be the main frameworks of that bridge. And we had a list of about six or seven things to look at under the rubric of competitiveness and trade policy and so on. And by the end of the study, I came up with the notion that what we really should focus on is trying to set conditions for the internet and electronic commerce to take off, because that could be the biggest engine of economic growth in the next few decades if we do it right. And then closely behind that, that the commercial implications of the Human Genome Project and also clean energy were going to be three areas that needed frameworks so that they could take off from government's predictable frameworks, and that if we could get those right, it would make a big difference to the American economy and the world economy. And I remember the meeting, the cabinet meeting, where this was discussed. And a number of the cabinet officials had been eyeing me warily because they knew that I was close to the president, that I was still there after health reform, and therefore I was probably going to do something significant, and they were afraid that it was going to be in their turf. And when they heard that what I was proposing was to do this thing on something called the internet, which most of them still only vaguely knew what it was, they were delighted because they thought, okay, well, fine, if he wants to go off and do that, that's fine with us. But the president got it. He understood the potential significance of electronic commerce and the internet and said, go have at it. And what I found in the government, that there were people like Becky Burr and others who were in different departments of the government who had been thinking and working on this issue for a number of years without the kind of high-level visibility at the White House that was really deserved. And so we pulled together a group from virtually all the major departments of government to try to figure out what kind of framework we could create. We then consulted very widely among many people in this room and industry, and then eventually came up with the framework. I think the greatest significance of the framework from my point of view is, as they say, the dogs that didn't bark, the things that didn't happen that could have happened. If you go back to the environment we found when we first started going around the world talking about the internet, there was very active discussion, you may remember, about a bit tax, and the European Union was talking about imposing a tax on every bit of transmission that took place. The International Telecommunications Union, after 10 years of fighting the internet protocols, all of a sudden decided they're going to happen, therefore they ought to control it. And so they wanted to take over international regulatory control, and the FCC also was looking at taking over domestic regulatory control and regulating the internet as it did ordinary telecom. This was also just before the Supreme Court struck down the first anti-pornography, the censorship rules. So there was aim and intent to censor the internet virtually everywhere in the world, including in the United States. I remember when I first had breakfast with Martin Bangemann, who some of you may remember, who was the head of the, or the director general for the EU area that covered the internet. There were two observations of that breakfast that struck me most that I'll never forget. One is that, for those of you who remember Martin, I've never seen anybody eat so much at one meal in my life. He was about 400 pounds, and he just kept shoveling it in. But the second thing was that the serious proposal he had for me on the table was that really the U.S. and EU ought to get together and set all the technical standards for what the internet would look like, because after all, we needed common technical standards in order for the internet to take off. As was mentioned, the French had their Minitel, and among the most significant things was that there was a series of lawsuits that were working their way through different courts all around the world, challenging the internet protocols and challenging John Postel and USC as being the handers out of the internet addresses, challenging DARPA, which then controlled the routing system of the internet. And the head of DARPA, I remember, called me on literally the day after this cabinet meeting and said, look, we got to get DARPA out of this. We got to get us out of it. We're being sued. You know, the government has to protect us in these lawsuits. And we saw a situation where the internet could have degenerated into a situation where different judges who might not have had a clue what it was all around the world were going to be setting regulations for how the internet ought to be organized. And I remember talking to Lou Gerstner at the time, and you know his and others' concerns was, look, we're going to put hundreds of millions of dollars at the time into the internet and electronic commerce, but how can we do that when we don't know if it's going to have a coherent routing system? We don't know what's going to happen. And the final thing I remember is I decided to, not being a technical person, to try to learn what I could, and Mike Nelson and others did their best to teach me technically to their great frustration. But one thing I did understand was that you had these dozen or so routers that basically were the internet architecture, and there were concerns about the security of them. And I remember walking into a couple of unnamed university basements where two of these things existed, and I could have, you know, blown these things up or taken them apart or, you know, started typing Mary Had a Little Lamb into them, and nobody would have noticed. There was nobody watching the internet routing system. So that was the environment in which the framework came into being. And I would say that probably the greatest accomplishment of the framework is all those things that could have happened that didn't. We got an agreement in the World Trade Organization that there would not be any tariffs on electronic commerce. We got the Internet Tax Freedom Act done, which at least withheld the kind of sales tax and other taxation that could have been done state by state that would have been a nightmare. We kept the ITU out of it by forming ICANN, which for all its blemishes still exists and has been reasonably functional, and it got rid of all the lawsuits. And it, you know, I guess when the time came up to renew it or not, it was renewed, so that says something. But it actually has, I think, done a credible job of keeping things organized without too much government regulation. And it was, I think, a first of its kind in the sense that it was a private international nonprofit organization recognized by governments to coordinate the architecture of the internet, and that had never been done before, I think, as a legal form. But we got the EU and the Japanese and the Australians and others to sign on to it and created a structure that stood the test of time. We had the Millennium Copyright Act, which established some basic copyright framework for the internet, Digital Signatures Act, which kept governments out of creating governmental mechanisms. We kept it so that the industry formed standards, not governments. There were a variety of other kind of market-driven approaches that we took. We kept a renewal of calls for censorship away from the U.S. and also other countries. And so there were a series of things that got put into place which I think prevented bad things from happening. And the guiding principle that we were operating under is that, I guess twofold, two things. One is that we could not predict, nor could anyone, what the potential of the internet was and how the competition would play out. And therefore, the worst thing we could do is try to regulate it and set constraints on it that might inhibit its organic growth. And so we needed to let it grow in a free enough manner to take the course that citizens of the world and the marketplace would have it take. And that meant keeping very much of a hands-off approach. And we took that not from ideology. You know, if we were talking about healthcare, I think the government has a significant role to play in healthcare. But when we were talking about the internet, it was as pure a market as one could imagine, and therefore the government, we felt, should keep a hands off as much as possible and just set basic frameworks that were non-regulatory and non-intrusive, and that was just a practical answer of the way the internet should be allowed to grow. We also, Lynn Margerio is in the room, who was the principal author of the report that we put out, which was the first official report, The Emerging Digital Economy, talking about the potential from the Commerce Department of the Internet economy, has the interesting distinction that the day after that report came out is when the Internet bubble took off in terms of the financial craziness that went on. That report had projected roughly that the Internet economy would grow for a decade or two at about 10 times the rate of the regular economy, and it put some definitions in place of the Internet economy. What happened after the report was issued is that everybody in New York who was jealous of everybody in California who was making all the money on the early Internet investments said, I got to get me some of that, and they went looking for anybody under 30 who knew how to use a computer to throw money at. And we had the Internet bubble, so the Internet economy grew at a couple of 100% a year for a number of years, then crashed and so on. But interestingly enough, if you look at the trend line, it has grown about 10 times the rate of the regular economy since that time, albeit not in a straight line. So that also, I think, inspired confidence in a lot of people that this thing was real and it was going to happen. There are a couple of things, if I look back at what we also did, which we could use more of, is everything we did. The president used to joke to me that I was the only senior member of his administration who requested that the stuff that he was working on not be included in the State of the Union. And the reason was because in the partisan atmosphere that existed around that time, and which has continued to this day, anything that was put front and center by the president in the State of the Union immediately got attacked and opposed by the opposition party. Everything we did, all the pieces of legislation we had bipartisan sponsorship and support. Chris Cox was there on one of them, Orrin Hatch on another, Spencer Abraham on another. We had a bipartisan sponsorship, Newt Gingrich on the Tax Freedom Act, so that we were able to get significant majorities and pass the whole agenda during a time when very, very little was moving in the Congress because it was a very partisan period. And the other thing we were able to do was to get international agreement in countries, including France, where there was great suspicion about the U.S. role in all of this, certainly suspicion that our security agencies would be monitoring everything in the world, but also suspicion that somehow this would be good for the U.S. economy, but not for everybody else. And I remember going to France the first time and meeting then Prime Minister Jospin about this, and they still had the Minitel, and they were trying to decide which way to go. And we purposely, Bill Daley and I, did an interview with Le Monde on the way in because we knew they were sympathetic to the Internet, and we said to them that, look, in a couple of years, there are going to be a billion people on the Internet, and nobody's going to care if 50 million Frenchmen aren't there, but it's going to be your problem if they're not. And Le Monde then came out with a very long story and an editorial advocating that France really had to join the international Internet movement and not try to go its own way. If I look back and say, what I'm most disappointed about, obviously whenever you try to take a non-regulatory approach, it's not something that you do once. It's something that you're going to have to keep doing because there's going to always be an impetus from government to try to come in and regulate in some way. And so that was sort of expected, and I think those battles you all are fighting on a regular basis and will likely continue to fight. Perhaps what was unexpected and disappointing to me is two things. First is that if anybody had said to me 10 years ago that the United States would be number 15 in the world in broadband deployment, I would have said, no way, that's impossible, that couldn't happen. Because at that point, of course, the U.S. had by far the best Internet infrastructure in the world. And if anybody had said to me that Korea would be number one or two, I would have said that they were smoking something, because I first went to Korea right after we released the report. I went on a visit to about 15 countries to try to talk to them about the report. And when I got to Korea, they didn't know what I was talking about, what the Internet was. And there was a cartoon on the front page of the leading Korean daily with a picture of me and then a picture of a Korean farmer with Clinton Internet floating overhead, and there was a kind of sense of what is this? What is this? You know, what is he here to talk about? And yet, within a matter of 5 or 6 years, Korea had higher levels, percentages of internet penetration than the United States. So that, to me, is, in my view at least, one of the major things that we have to redress. We're not going to be able to maintain our economic leadership and also our technological leadership if we are so poor in our broadband access and in our ability to utilize the internet in an effective way. The other thing that I think is a bit disappointing to me, and this is something that I hope will change, I have the sense, and maybe Stuart and others will disabuse me of this, that that IT-related issues and the importance of the IT industry overall has been perhaps less recognized over the past years in Washington than it was during the last 4 years of the Clinton administration. And I think that if it is true, I'm not in Washington these days, but if it is true, I hear it from people, would be disappointing because this industry is still going to represent a significant amount of growth potential for this country growth in income and growth in good jobs and technological growth. And so I think it needs the kind of attention that will allow that to happen. Not attention that's going to regulate it, but attention that will create the kind of supportive environment that is necessary. So let me close by thanking Ken and everybody here for coming and for remembering. It's a bit strange to be part of history. It's like when I read my name in my kids' high school history books, it scares the hell out of me about how old I'm getting. But sometimes history has a way of repeating itself, so we'll have to see what happens over the next couple of years. But in any event, I appreciate being invited, and I look forward to the panel discussion. Thank you.